normalize ties with Israel. Palestinians believe that resistance against occupation is the only way they have to achieve their goals.
People in the besieged Gaza Strip held a rally following the Friday prayers to express their solidarity with Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowing to sacrifice their lives for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Earlier, the Israeli regime forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds, injuring more than 150 worshippers during the second Friday of the fasting holy month of Ramadan. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
We are prepared to wage wars for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will continue to the equation of arms for arms and blood for blood, and that Al-Quds is a red line that must not be crossed. The Israeli occupation will bear full responsibility for any repercussions as a result of its attacks against the worshippers. We are ready for all scenarios to stop this enemy and protect our people.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to increase their solidarity with Al-Quds until the removal of all Israeli violations in the holy city.
The Palestinian people are united for the sake of Al-Quds, and we will not abandon Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will fight for the sake of Al-Quds and sacrifice our lives for it.
The Israeli regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression in Al-Quds since the beginning of Ramadan. Palestinian resistance factions warned the Israeli regime of dire consequences if Israeli forces continue to attack Al-Quds.
The Israeli is sending a clear message to the Zionist enemy that it must understand that we will not sit idle while it attacks Al-Quds. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire, and it will only explode in its face.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal enclave say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The latest second-round polls in France continue to show that Emmanuel Macron's once comfortable lead has vanished to make the race a dead heat. The mainstream media's insistence on talking about Islamophobia and xenophobia has already produced near-record abstention, but the unrest in Ukraine has forced real issues back to the fore. First the Great Recession, then the Age of Austerity, then the Yellow Vest Civil War, then the coronavirus era, and now an era of Russian sanctions? Devoted Europhile Macron remains committed to a long-term blockade of Russia, which requires years of economic suffering for the average household. Analysts say that voters may prefer Le Pen's France-first insistence that any Russia sanctions not bankrupt French homes and businesses.
She's a nationalist, and she's protectionist in some way. She's also protective. She has understood that it was important to sound as someone that would be here to take care of electors. It's whether it's for good or bad, but a lot of French people want to feel that they have a protective hand in government.
Le Pen has also promised to pull out of NATO's command center to restore French independence. Macron is relying on a demonization campaign of the National Front, just like in 2017. When the number two reason people voted for Macron was to block them from coming to power.
He is, in a way, a president by default. The number one paradox of this campaign is that, indeed, we've had 5 years of a president who's managed to be disliked by almost everybody and who yet is favorite to be reelected.
Back when he thought victory was assured, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65 this fall. That may cost him key older and left-wing votes. He's backtracking and saying that he's now willing to listen to the ideas and desires of voters. Do left-wing voters believe Macron's claims that he's now willing to govern by consensus? Does France view Le Pen differently after 5 years of Macronism? The winning candidate may be the one who proves that they have changed the most since the very different year of 2017. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Arms trafficking at Italy's main sea dispatch points is ongoing in breach of international and Italian laws. Dockers have found U.S.-made tanks in the hold of a Saudi ship docked at the port of Genoa. Our correspondent Max Civili has his report from Rome.
Italian ports have often been central to international arms trafficking over the past years. Cargos of weapons destined for war-torn countries have been intercepted in various seaports, including those of Livorno, Naples, and Gioia Tauro. On Wednesday, dockers belonging to the autonomous port workers collective CALP found tanks in the hold of the Saudi Arabian ship Bahri Jeddah, which is moored in the Italy's northern port of Genoa. CALP dockers have taken photos of the weapons placed on board the ship and published them on the collective's website.
The ship carries weapons and ammunition. We spotted M1 Abrams tanks already armed, produced in the US. On the deck of the ship, there are also containers full of ammunition and explosives in plain sight. It is extremely dangerous and against international and Italian laws.
About 10 days ago, CALP dockers, together with rights associations and pacifist movements, staged a protest demanding the port authority more transparency on ships' cargoes transiting in Genoa. Dockers have said the demands have not yet been addressed.
These ships carrying cargo of arms and explosives are not just operating in breach of international and Italian laws. Cargo of this sort is extremely dangerous for the dockers and for thousands of people living in the surroundings of the port of Genoa. In addition to that, ships are moored near a chemical warehouse and an oil depot. You can imagine the safety implications of that.
The Weapon Watch Observatory has also found that the number of Italian aircraft carriers that are transporting weapons towards Poland has dramatically increased over the past weeks. Rome has been sending tons of arms and humanitarian aid to Ukraine since the start of the conflict there. The arms industry in Italy is prospering. 10 years ago, Rome was the 10th largest weapons producer in the world. Today it stands as the 6th. Furthermore, following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, the Mario Draghi government has honored a pledge made to NATO a few years ago, rising military spending from 1.4 to 2% of GDP by 2028. Max Civili, Rome.
Millions of EU citizens are really starting to feel the pinch. Inflation in the 19-country eurozone is currently at 7.5%. The European Central Bank, ECB, wants inflation to be at just below 2%. It means the cost of living is out of control.
The impact of the war on the economy will depend on how the conflict evolves, on the effect of current sanctions, and on possible further measures.
On Thursday, the ECB said energy prices have increased by 45% in the past 12 months. Business and consumer confidence has fallen through the floor due to the conflict in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia. There are major supply issues. The cost of living is rising, but wages are not, according to the ECB. We have been speaking to EU citizens.
We have also a lot of refugees in Poland, so it's also a huge problem now for our country, for the healthcare system and every other area.
We have to take the car, we're trying to take everybody at the same place and try to share with other peoples, and of course everything in the food also. I mean, it's a big problem, yeah.
When I drive with a car or something and the prices went so high, as a student I cannot pay it.
If the Ukrainian conflict continue, there will be problem because Russian and Ukraine are two of the most important food producers, so there will be problem about food price.
And as a business person, are you worried about losing your business?
Yeah, it's stopping if you don't have the parts to construct your thing.
The next update from the European Central Bank is scheduled to take place on the 9th of June. So how badly could things possibly deteriorate for EU citizens between now and then? To quote the head of the bank, Christine Lagarde, who knows? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Memorial service is held to pay tribute to a major figure in the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, late Lieutenant General Mohammad Hejazi. Hejazi was the deputy commander of the IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. The top general died last year after years of battling the effects of exposure to chemical agents in Iraqi gas attacks during the 1980s Iran-Iraq War.
General Hejazi was on the front line of the fight against the occupying Israeli regime. He was highly skilled in scouting for and training members of the resistance. The likes of General Hejazi and General Soleimani trained many resistance members who have turned into flag bearer of the resistance axis.
Hejazi's name goes hand in hand with Major General Qasem Soleimani, an anti-terror military commander who was assassinated in a U.S. air raid in Iraq in January 2020. IRGC officials say Hejazi stood shoulder to shoulder with General Soleimani in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria.
When it comes to the fight against Daesh terrorists, General Hejazi played a key role in training the resistance fighters both physically and ideologically to readily fight the terror group. He led several operations that dealt heavy blows to the terrorists.
General Hejazi joined the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps during the early days of its establishment in 1979. He was a veteran of the eight-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, before being appointed as the head of the Basij, a paramilitary force affiliated to the IRGC. Hejazi also served as an intelligence and security advisor to Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. He became the deputy commander of the Quds Force in late January 2020, after the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani. He was on the list of the U.S. and Europe sanctions as part of bans imposed on the IRGC.
From serving in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s to fighting terrorism in the region, General Hejazi grew to become a vital piece in the IRGC's activities, so that the military force still mourns his death as a huge loss. That's, quote, irreplaceable. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A hearing to review the case of a Palestinian prisoner has been held at an Israeli court. After the hearing, the court said Ahmad Manasra's case doesn't apply under terrorism laws. This means his lawyers can appeal for his release. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
Ahmad Manasra, this Palestinian youth, who was arrested 6 years ago when he was only 13 years old, is suffering mental health issues due to torture and solitary confinement he faces in Israeli jail. Ahmed's lawyers had appealed to the Israeli court against a special prison committee's rejection of a request to have Ahmed's case reviewed by a parole committee after he had served two-thirds of his sentence. The Israeli court of Bir al-Sabah held a hearing to review Ahmed's case. They only decided that his case doesn't come under the terrorism law.
Ahmad Manasra is an example of the persecution of children in Palestine. He's a child who was arrested while he was 13 years old only. He was persecuted, he was oppressed, he was tortured, and he was frightened, and he has become a victim of physical and psychological abuse from the Israeli side. That's why there is a huge campaign now demanding his release.
After years of his detention, no one can forget the video of an Israeli interrogator violently questioning a Palestinian child. In the video, Israeli interrogator kept screaming at Ahmed and accusing him of lying. Ahmed repeatedly told the interrogator that he couldn't remember. Ahmed was referring to the day when Israeli settlers opened fire at him and left him bleeding on the ground after being run over by an Israeli settler's car. Israeli settlers cursed him, damning him to death. This came after his 15-year-old cousin Hassan was shot dead by Israeli settlers. They accused both Ahmed and Hassan of attempting to carry out a knife-stabbing attack.
The Israeli committee originally rejected looking into Ahmad Mansara's file on the basis that its case falls under the terrorism law. Now, after the latest ruling, Ahmad's lawyers want to request to have his case reviewed by a parole committee. He has served 6 of his 9-year sentence and is suffering from mental health issues.
A global solidarity campaign has pressured the Israeli courts to hold a hearing to review and possibly appeal Ahmad's case.
The Israeli court has only decided to cancel the previous decision that Ahmad Manasra's case comes under the so-called terrorism law. However, Ahmad's family and lawyers hope that the next session will be soon, as there is a serious need to release Ahmad immediately due to his severely deteriorated mental condition. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
Thank you.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In as many days, at least 19 Palestinians were injured in clashes as Israeli settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds under the protection of Israeli military forces. Israel is not holding back its acts of provocation, especially during the holy month of Ramadan, which is why Palestinians are also acting out their frustrations against them. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the source of the problems between Israelis and Palestinians, in which Al-Quds is just one flashpoint. Let's first find out what happened. Mona Kandil is our correspondent who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Tell us about the incident again, which has recurred at Al-Aqsa.
Well, what happened this morning is just before the Fajr morning prayers, Israeli police closed all the gates leading to the old town of Al-Quds as well as to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and then allowed only men over the age of 40 to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque for prayers, while holding their IDs with the Israeli soldiers at the military checkpoint. Following the morning prayers, Israeli soldiers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and forced the people, the worshippers, out of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. However, a number of Palestinians were inside the Qibli and the Golden Dome Mosque. They remained in these mosques. However, the Israeli soldiers shut the gates of those two mosques and kept the people inside while allowing Israeli settlers to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. According to the Israeli media, some 728 Israeli settlers under heavy protection from Israeli soldiers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and toured in the Muslim holy site while not allowing the Palestinians, the Muslims, to freely pray inside the mosques and the complex as well. Of course, the clashes took place between the Palestinian worshippers and Israeli soldiers, who, of course, attacked the people and brutally they beaten people with their arms and they also fired heavy tear gas against the Palestinians. At least a dozen of Palestinians were wounded and transferred to hospitals in Al-Quds.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Mona Kandil, correspondent there from occupied Ramallah. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Sid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joins us from Islamabad. Also joining us, Sami Hamdi, editor-in-chief at the International Interest, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Sami Hamdi, I'm going to first start with you. When you take a look at this incident, again, we're looking at violence to have broken out, and you're looking at the way that Palestinians have been injured, 19 of them. Of course, the day before was worse, it was more severe. They say it's because this occasion coincides with Ramadan, when you have Muslims and also Passover and all that, but really the source of the problem is much deeper than that. What are your thoughts on this?
I think it's important, first and foremost, to stress that every Ramadan we see these sort of see this take place. We see a repetition of the Israelis essentially provoking the Palestinians, trying to force them into a confrontation, trying to force them into violence in a bid through which the Israeli or the occupation government, the apartheid regime, can then clamp down and essentially try to use those images to the world to say, look, this is a very unstable situation, and therefore we are the ones who are supposed to task with finding a resolution. The reason being is that what the Israeli government seeks to do, what the apartheid regime in Tel Aviv seeks to do, is to try to make life unbearable for the Palestinians in the Jerusalem area so that the Palestinians will leave. The regime in Tel Aviv, the apartheid regime, has been under significant pressure as a result of the media narrative that is changing as a result of Palestinians and their use of social media. The regime in Tel Aviv wants to make life unbearable for Palestinians in their use of the holy sites, in the use of Al-Aqsa Mosque, in trying to secure basic needs, in going to the market, going to schools, in increasing checkpoints, so that the regime, the apartheid regime in Tel Aviv, can then turn around and say that we did not force them out, they chose to leave by themselves, and this is why we're choosing to demolish the homes in Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah, and this is why we're seizing control of Al-Aqsa. This is all about a long-term strategy that we've seen implemented in other areas. The idea here being that given that the international consciousness that is changing as a result of the activism of Palestinians, given that has resulted in the inability of the apartheid regime to use brute force to oust the Palestinians from their land, and given now that they are resorting to other tactics in which they are making life unbearable in the hope that these aggressions that they are embarking on against the Palestinians will essentially make the Palestinians leave their territory. And you'll remember former Qatari Prime Minister Hamad bin Jassim, who suggested that there were even some Arab countries that have offered to buy the homes of some of these Palestinians in the Jerusalem area and then handing them over to the Israelis. The idea here being this is about demographic change. This is about trying to bring about demographic change. And this is why we see this on a consistent basis, these umbrella reasons used such as Passover or the like, in a bid to push the Palestinians out of a land that they are dedicated to remaining in come what may.
Sure. Well, say Mohsen Abbas, Israel does have a way of spinning this, and we know that that's what they want the world to say in terms of their spin. From what we understand, they are saying that, you know, this raid, as they call it, they always call it a raid, is an effort to protect the freedom of worship from violent rioters that are desecrating the site and endangering the public. Although we know that there are videos that show otherwise. Of what has happened. Do you think that the world is buying the Israeli narrative, or as our guest Sami Hamdan said there, activist voices are now reaching the masses?
Well, I think there is a world move against Israel, without a doubt. And that's why they are taking increasingly desperate measures. And I think these kinds of actions, especially in the middle of Ramadan, show that desperation, because to attack innocent worshippers at a time which is their most sacred moment in the year, and actually to still try to justify that, clearly is an act of desperation. Clearly, it's not going to win them any brownie points with Muslims around the world, and it's certainly not going to allow them to be able to do the PR spin that they are usually very hell-bent on doing. So I'd say that overall, I mean, they're just falling into the trap that they built for themselves, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Lynx, this year, of course, submitted that report to the Human Rights Council, and they concluded very clearly that they are essentially operating an apartheid system, racially motivated oppression against Palestinians, and explicitly designed to maintain Jewish-Israeli domination, as he put it. Well, the Palestinians have known... and their own human rights organizations, they've known for many years that this is the case. And the situation of apartheid is manifested more so by the religious persecution that you see here.
I'm very interested, Sami Hamdi, on the comment that you made about this former Qatari official in terms of buying homes from the Palestinians and handing it over to Israel. Can you tell us about that, or refresh our memory on that, if you can?
The former Qatari Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Hamad bin Jassim, often considered the architect of the modern Qatari foreign policy that enabled them to expand their influence across the Muslim world and beyond, and also at one point to become the most important lobbying power in Washington. Hamad bin Jassim, in an interview that he gave last year, suggested that there were states that were working with Israel, getting close with Israel, and by in doing so were embarking on actions such as buying land and or homes from the Palestinians and handing it off to Israelis. According to Hamad bin Jassim, he described that usually when states get close to Israel, it's not usually because they like Israel, it's mainly because they want access to the White House or access to Congress. But he described that in particular one nation, and here the allusion is towards the UAE or the implications of the UAE, although he did not state them specifically, that the UAE have been buying property of the Palestinians, given that the Palestinians are not willing to sell their land to the Israelis. The UAE have gone on the pretext that the Palestinians would be willing to sell their land to a Muslim brother, and then that UAE would later on go on and sell that land later on to the Israeli government as part of this demographic change, part of trying to change the formation of the population within the Jerusalem territories, given that Israel in the past has been able to argue that Palestinians have left their lands in other areas, but the Palestinians in the Jerusalem area, specifically in Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwan, and these others, have been quite problematic for the apartheid regime in Tel Aviv because they refused to leave. They refused to take the offers on the part of the apartheid regime. They refused to bow to the pressure to leave their homes. They refused to sell their land. They continue to go to international public opinion, international courts to try to stop the demolition of their homes. The idea being that Tel Aviv now is trying to use another way to bring about this demographic change by hoodwinking some of those Palestinians into selling land to allies of the Tel Aviv regime and apartheid, by hoodwinking them into selling land to those who are ostensibly coming across as in a brotherly environment,
sure,
and that land slowly making its way to the apartheid regime, which then proceeds to demolish land or the like. But the idea here being is that in this overall theme that we're seeing with what Hamad bin Jassim said, with what we're seeing in Al-Aqsa Mosque, with what we're seeing in terms of the provocations towards the Palestinians, the aim is clear: to oust the Palestinians from that territory, to change it demographically, and to accelerate this change in the demographics quickly, given that the mood, the international mood is changing, given that Amnesty is now using words such as apartheid, given Human Rights Watch is now using words such as apartheid, given the word apartheid is now being used even in the US Congress, given that now we saw Nicholas Kristof, who wrote in the New York Times or one of the major American papers, that the relationship between the US and Israel is no longer unshakable. The idea here being that the Palestinian activism, as a result of social media that allows them to bypass mainstream media,
right,
has allowed a change in the narrative, and Israel is therefore feels there is an impetus or a need to accelerate the change in demographics before things get much worse.
Sure. Well, that's interesting. So, Mohsen Abbas, so you heard our guest there. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, basically, we're looking at countries, Arab countries, that are going ahead with their normalization with Israel, and perhaps one of the prerequisites, in a sense, or maybe I shouldn't use that word, but one of the conditions is for them to go ahead and buy Palestinian land so they can have a foothold in the White House. Give us your reaction on this.
Well, I think the important point is that everything that's happened since the so-called normalization process, which United Arab Emirates and Bahrainis and others have been touting, including the Moroccans as well, is that all of that has been proven to be absolutely the wrong direction to take. And quite frankly, the Israeli actions against the Palestinians haven't improved at all. Rather, they've got much worse. And the truth is that the first thing that all of these Arab nations, which have essentially sold out, need to think again. They need to think seriously about reversing those policies, number one, because they haven't produced any of the supposed results which they had said they would with their normalization. So this complicity, first of all, would be something that needs to be erased, and they need to reconvene with their other Arab and neighbors and Iran and the various other nations in that region, and actually have a united stand against Israel, making it quite clear that the only solution for Israel really is for it to return all of the land to the Palestinians, to have free and fair elections for all people, everybody in the diaspora, which has a heritage link to Palestine, and to create a state which is based on justice and fairness and equality, not a Jewish fundamentalist state which is hell-bent on using the boot to put under heel the Palestinian people and to muzzle them and to treat them as essentially as animals. That's exactly what they're doing. And so I think that the statements from the foreign minister of Iran, Mr. Khatibzadeh, have been very, very strong on this. And he said very clearly that the violation of human rights, the principles and of international law, which are being shown to be committed as crimes in Al-Aqsa Mosque as we speak almost, are all things which need to be taken seriously, both by the international community, but they also demonstrate that the Zionist regime has become too weak to withstand the uprising of the Palestinian people. And this return of the Intifada, if you like, after the Operation Al-Quds Sword, he said, are all indications of how weak Israel is, and the weaker it is, the more desperate it's going to become. But what the more desperate it becomes and the more atrocities it commits, quite clearly, the more the Palestinians themselves are going to be in a rage and will want their freedom, okay, and will fight for it. And that looks like the way it's going to go. And really, I think Israel, the writing seems to be on the wall, both externally and internally, because not only has the Iron Dome and all the myth of Israeli military invincibility been shattered, with their recent escapade, they've also had that myth shattered because they were too weak to even think about invading Gaza militarily. So you can see that their lack of confidence is emanating in their military strategy. Now on the ground, what we're witnessing is this persistent and consistent uprising of Palestinians, which we've seen rising over the last year or so. And of course, we're seeing their desperation in terms of going and attacking worshippers, which is a massive public relations own goal for them. It's really not looking very healthy for the Israelis, and they really need to take stock and realize that I think that the time is up. They need to be really thinking about other ways, sure, of dealing with the way they've stolen that land.
Well, so you have these few days here, Sami Hamdi, of the violence that took place at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and of course Israeli forces and the way they conducted themselves against the Palestinians. You have basically the most recent uptick in violence overall in the occupied territories. I'm looking at two more Palestinian youths to have been killed during a raid just 4 days ago in Jenin. Six to have been killed in a matter of 24 hours. Number of Palestinians killed this past week or so now, totaling about 20. You still have about a couple weeks left to Ramadan. I mean, if we are going to go on, continue on this track, or if Israel is going to continue on this track, you're going to have a lot of bloodshed. Why isn't there a reaction coming in terms of the force of concentration by the U.S. and Europeans on Ukraine as to what's going on here in the occupied territories?
Well, if you ask, that's a very good question. I think for Biden, he feels he doesn't need this particular headache. He's focused on Ukraine. He's focused on his allies with Europe. He's focused on why he's unable to get some of his Middle East allies to take his side with regards to this war that's taking place between Russia and Ukraine. He's worried about the negotiations with Iran in terms of establishing a new Iran deal. This matter is way below the pecking order with regards to his particular concerns, especially when he's receiving reassurances on the part of Israeli officials that this is a temporary measure and it will not last especially long. It's also important to put yourself in the position of the regime in Tel Aviv, the idea being that you have Turkey's Erdogan chasing reconciliation, you have Morocco improving its ties with you, UAE improving its ties, Saudi Arabia is signaling increasing normalization of ties. The idea here being that even when you look at Pakistan, the fall of Imran Khan and the likes, you feel like that even in the Muslim world, there is not technically a united front anymore with regards to Palestine that might pressure the Americans into taking a stance in the manner that perhaps they've been able to do in previous times. With regards to Europe, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, issued a statement. He's called on the Israelis to show restraint. That appears to be a more protocol statement, even if perhaps I believe Antonio Guterres often to be a sincere individual in this. But for Europe, Russia is the main problem. This issue is not something that is of particular priority. And this is why the environment is conducive now for the apartheid regime to continue these escalations in a manner that tries to prevent a war from taking place with Hamas or with Gaza, in a way of ensuring that while Ukraine dominates the headlines, this is the time in which to be able to embark on more aggressive measures, given that it won't receive the international attention that it might achieve. But I think more than blaming the US and Europe, I think what's different this time, particularly given that US and Europe in the past have never been really the first to condemn Israel, what's different this time is the stance in the Muslim world. The idea being that the leaders of the Muslim world, or the most of the leaders of the Muslim world, most of the traditional leaders that we've come to expect to release very strong worded statements, to embark on lobbying efforts, to really push to try to restrain Israel or push within their means, we're seeing these traditional leaders rather embark on an approach of trying to reconcile Tel Aviv, or being careful not to upset Tel Aviv, being careful not to ruin their ties or relations with Tel Aviv. And that includes the likes of Erdogan and others. And that is the saddening tragedy of this particular environment in which these events are taking place. I do think, however, that despite this, I do think that Tel Aviv is very keen not to instigate a new war with Gaza. It's well aware that it suffered from its war against Gaza last year. It lost its monopoly over the narrative. It lost its control over the discourse. It suffered as a result of its relations that have now come under question between Tel Aviv and Europe, between Tel Aviv and Washington. Israel doesn't want to get involved in that once more. And the final point that's worth noting is this. Remember that Bennett's government in Tel Aviv is a very precarious composition of multiple parties, whereby if even one withdraws, then his government collapses. And amongst that government are those who are Palestinians. And if they choose to leave the government, his government will come tumbling. He's not in the position Netanyahu used to be beforehand. And this is why I think that while we see these provocations taking place at the moment, if push comes to shove, I do think Bennett is not in a position to provoke an all-out war. But then again, nothing is really surprising when it comes from the apartheid regime.
If we were to follow that narrative of our guest Sami Hamdi, say Mohsen Abbas, why are Arab leaders or the Muslim world's leaders retracting and trying to be cautious about this situation instead of them being on the offensive in terms of condemnation or what have you?
Well, because they're Zionists. They are Arab Zionists. There's no ifs and buts. They can dress themselves up as they like, but all their actions are those of Zionists. All their alliances are with Zionist institutions, whether they're Anglo-Zionist or directly Zionist institutions. I think we've come to expect very little from the likes of Erdogan, even Erdogan and the Qataris, who were supposed to be the other supportive element for the Palestinians. Even they've clearly shown a level of hypocrisy, which outdoes a lot of what they've been doing in the past. But of course, the likes of Saudi Arabia, who are hypocritically offering their condolences to Palestinians and making sort of statements about how upset they are. The reality is that they've got a total lock-in with Anglo-Zionist imperialist interests, and that's who they operate for. And the minnows, like, of course, the United Arab Emirates or Kuwait and other such folk, again, they are in the same camp. But this has been a reality of the Middle East for many, many decades, obviously, and it will break, because the reality is that they have a resistance axis of which now Palestine is very much a part. I think that was a little bit touch and go for a fair while, because the Palestinians were often being confused by the likes of Turkey and Qatar and others to say they would come to their rescue. There's been no such thing. The only rescue package for Palestinians on a military level is ultimately going to be, let's face it, from the axis of resistance. And they've shown that results in Yemen, results in Iraq, results in Syria have achieved victory to the point where at least the Anglo-Zionist imperialists cannot have their own way and are not able to dominate totally. Lebanon is another example. Palestine, I think now, as Ismail Haniyeh, for the Political Bureau of Hamas, said just recently, is now ready to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque at all costs. And this spiritual defense, okay, this religious defense, is something that can resonate across most of the resistance, sure, axis, and those Muslims that actually are genuinely not Zionists.
Thank you very much. We're fresh out of time. Thank you for that. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from Islamabad. And we'd like to thank Sami Hamdi, also editor-in-chief of the International Interest from London. And we had our correspondent Monica Ndil from Ramallah at the top of the spotlight. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahweh and the team, is goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. We have been fasting for some 2 weeks. By the way, we have tasted the sweetness of worship. One of the factors that prevent tasting the sweetness is the right of people. There are three rights in Islam: the right of the self, the right of God, and the right of people. The right of the self means we are not allowed to wrong ourselves by wasting the lifetime. We should use the talents that God has gifted us correctly. If we do not fulfill the right of the self, we can compensate it by repenting. The right of God includes acts like daily ritual prayers, fasting, and other obligatory acts, and also refraining from forbidden acts. There are many narrations that God will pardon his right if the individual repents honestly and does not have time to compensate. But the right of people is very important in Islam, and one cannot get rid of them by mere repenting. Part of this right includes financial issues, while the other part includes
spiritual issues such as dignity and honor of individuals. This right should be compensated exactly as it has been violated. In other words, God will never forgive the violated right of people unless we get back the money that we owe to somebody or retaliate for defaming an individual. The right of people is so important that if we are indebted to someone and he demands it while we are in daily ritual prayer, we have to stop the prayer and spend his debt and then continue the prayer. 1,400 years ago, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, son of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, has mentioned the rights of everything and everyone which should be observed by the faithful. Without observing these rites, we cannot taste the sweetness of worship, and consequently, we won't reach high degrees of servitude of God. Undoubtedly, the Prophet and his progeny, the Ahlul Bayt, are the best role models for mankind. Familiarity with their characteristics and pondering over their practice and behavior demonstrates the sublime and purposeful life. Imam Hassan, peace upon him, was asked on the reason of prescribing fasting. The Imam answered, God has prescribed fasting in order that the rich taste hunger and spend the surplus of their wealth to the poor. Imam Hassan, peace upon him, was very kind and forgiving. One day a man had come to Medina from Syria. He found Imam Hassan and started insulting the Imam as a result of negative propaganda of the Umayyad rulers that had spread across Syria. When he got tired of insulting, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, cast him an affectionate look and, after reciting a few ayahs on pardoning others, told the man, O man, we are ready for any kind of service to you. Then the Imam asked him, Are you from Syria? The man answered, Yes. Imam Hassan said, I know why you have behaved this way, but now that you are lonely in our city, if you need anything, I will help you and I'm ready to receive you at my home. The Syrian man never thought to face such kind of overlooking, so he was changed, as he said, At that time I wish the ground had swallowed me so that I couldn't have behaved so brazenly. Hassan and his father had been the worst people in my heart, but now I don't love anyone more than them. Now let's continue the laws of fasting. One of the things that nullify fasting is ascribing untrue issues and words to God, prophets, and imams. This will nullify fasting both in verbal and written form. Thus, one should be very careful about narrating hadith and words of the prophets and infallible imams. Yet, one can narrate hadith if he's not sure if they are true or not. But it is better to mention the reference. Ascribing untrue narrations and words to jurisprudence and ulema is forbidden and a great sin, but it does not nullify fasting. Another act which nullifies fasting is to dip the head completely in water. If this act is done deliberately, it will nullify fasting. So, if the person is forced to dip his head or he does it out of negligence, his fasting is correct. If he dips half of his head and then dips another half, his fasting is correct. Meanwhile, pouring water on the head with a dish or shower does not nullify fasting. If one doubts that his head was completely dipped in water, his fasting is correct. If he puts the whole head in water unintentionally, He should take it out as soon as he notices.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.